Hello, welcome to the Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. I spoke to Adam B. Levine a few weeks ago. We talked about his original Bitcoin podcast, The Daily Bitcoin, and why it morphed into Let's Talk Bitcoin with Andreas Antonopoulos and Stephanie Murphy. I found out how insanely early Adam wakes up each morning, got his takes on crypto crowdfunding platforms, as well as some of his grave concerns about U.S. crypto projects that have benefited from crowdfunding. Adam talked a bit about Tokenly, his newest entrepreneurial venture, but he also let me know about his newest technological passion, exploring the future of virtual reality with the Oculus Rift. Our conversation left me wondering if Adam might ever consider leaving the Bitcoin space for a fertile technology space that isn't being threatened by the U.S. government. As a fairly new podcaster on Adam's network and a longtime fan, I got to ask Adam questions about my position and the network in general. If you're a fan of Adam B. Levine or Let's Talk Bitcoin, I think this will be an interesting show for you. To find out more about anything we discuss, come find this episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com. So without further ado... Hi, Adam.
Hi, Rob.
During the early 2013 Bitcoin price frenzy that peaked around 260, I was just getting serious about Bitcoin. I was trying to learn whatever I could, and I think your podcast must have come out just as I was searching for Bitcoin podcasts, but we're talking about The Daily Bitcoin.
The Daily Bitcoin, that was a long time ago.
And I actually just listened to that too, and if anyone wants to hear the evolution of your Bitcoin podcast, it's still there on SoundCloud. But I feel like I was super fan pretty much since the beginning. It seemed like Bitcoin was the future. And, you know, it seemed like you were doing a really good job with explaining it, especially for me when I was pretty much a newbie. Can you talk about what happened to that original podcast and why you kind of changed co-hosts?
Man, that feels like so long ago. It's very interesting. You know, the key part about doing any of this stuff in a disruptive space, you know, what I'm doing is creating content, trying to help people understand stuff generally and trying to help get the word out about projects that are interesting and I think deserve more attention. The idea is that ideas are viral. The first show that we did, you know, I always wanted to do a weekly show, actually. It's sort of funny. We wound up doing a daily show. I put out a call in, I guess it was spring. This would have been, you know, before the first show started. For co-hosts, because I had done podcasts years before and had, you know, finally gotten back to a place in my life where I had time to do something like this. And Bitcoin was really exciting to me. And the thing that kept coming up was that there was no content out there unless you wanted to read something. And most of the articles that were being written at that point also were really, you know, were not really articles. They were more just kind of like helping everybody explain, but glossing over details or being incredibly in the overanalyzing side, or more importantly, being really, really focused on the price. The first episode of the Daily Bitcoin show that we did was actually kind of price focused. We started right in the middle of that bubble, and I there because I was like, yeah, I'd been trying to get it going for the last like 3 weeks before. One of the early people who I talked to about co-hosting it actually was Trace Mayer. We discussed doing that. We talked about doing it for the Bitcoin magazine for a while. And then there was Bertie Jaworski, who's gone on to be the editor over at the Very Much Wow magazine. She was another person who I talked about as a potential co-host. The people who I wound up with for that first episode was Eli Sklar out of Israel, and Paul, gosh, I can't remember his last name. I'm sorry, Paul. And Paul was in the East Coast US. There were a lot of things that were wrong with that show from my perspective. I had fun doing it, but trying to do a daily show, again, like I went into this whole thing with what I was calling my feats of strength. So doing the Daily Bitcoin show for a week with no budget, no help, doing it as an edited show, doing it in a timely fashion too. I mean, that was the thing is we would record at like 11 a.m. and then I would have the show out by like 5 or 6 p.m. Of that same day. And it was just me. And I was also doing most of the notes prep. You know, there was some help from the guys, but Paul got sick towards the end of the week. And just in general, it was one of the most stressful and also very exciting times of my life. And we took off right away. That was the thing is that, you know, I'm not good at a lot of things, but I'm pretty good at identifying opportunities. And I think that I correctly identified that there were a lot of people out there who would be really interested in consuming intelligent content, you know, talking about these things in a rational fashion. And So, you know, again, like you listen to the first episode and that's not really what we did. We were very excited about the price. The show actually isn't bad. If you go back and listen to it, I'm pretty happy with how things came out.
It is funny too, because you did have a more radio voice introducing that very first show. But it seemed just the time, what was going on with you with that podcast and my own steep learning curve at the time. It just seemed very frenetic and stressful and exciting. When I listened to that, it brought back all those kind of feelings I was having, trying to figure out Bitcoin and get into it. And this price was shooting up. And I don't know how much detail we want to get in, but I've always was just curious. You just unilaterally decided it wasn't working and searched new hosts?
Well, so we did 5 episodes. We got to the end of the week. I was planning on releasing an episode on Monday. It wasn't until about Sunday that I really crashed out, or it might have been Monday even. But the reality of it was that we had such little margin for error that I think it was Ellie did an interview with Mihai Alisi, the editor-in-chief at Bitcoin Magazine. That was what it was. He visited him in Israel and he did this interview. And it was my first time, actually. It was my first time talking with Mihai, who I've since become friends with. And Mihai, towards the end of it, after the interview had been turned in, after I had edited most of it, basically became very insecure about his accent. And so we wound up pulling it. And because we didn't get to run that, I didn't have the content to do it. And I didn't have the time to redo it. And even if I did have the time to redo it, I put in all this work to, this thing that then wasn't going to go out. And so it kind of just collapsed under its own weight. The guys wanted to continue doing it. And that was, it was a big point of stress. One of the other problems that we had was that by like day 3 of the show, we had been contacted by angel investors, basically. And one of them I was with for an extended period of time, and we kind of made a deal. And it was ridiculously, ridiculously unrealistic. In hindsight, looking back, the amount of money was maybe $10,000, and it was a lot of ownership too. And it just didn't work. I still have a good relationship with the guy. And what happened is he gave us the funds and then we started talking a little bit more about the specifics of the vision. And I realized that we were incompatible. And actually, it's interesting because the thing that we were incompatible on was I really, really, really didn't want to restrict ourselves. I wanted to have produced advertisements in the middle of the show. And he wanted us to just have call-ins at the beginning of the show and then just go straight in, or like do this segment is brought to you by this. So it's little issues like that that were really core. And again, like in hindsight, it hasn't mattered because monetization hasn't been such a thing. But at the same time, for better or worse, it's let me retain control of 100% of what it is that we're doing with Let's Talk Bitcoin. And also, you mentioned the intro, Stephanie, we brought her on after Justice Ranveer introduced me to her therapy show. And I asked her, we contracted with her to do our intro. And then Andreas was an expert on episode 5, which was the last episode that was produced, talking about he essentially just riffed on Mt. Gox and the either incompetence or the malfeasance or whatever. It was the first Andreas interview that I had ever done. And I was like, wow, this is a guy who I would like to have, we can't afford him, but I'd love to have him be part of what we're doing if he was going, if he was interested in. And it turned out that he was looking for a platform too. And so it wound up working really well. So that's kind of what happened is that, it went really well. We had, thousands of listeners for our first couple of episodes, but at the same time, the pace at which we had gone just left me completely collapsed. I took about 4 or 5 days of just like not looking at screens, not doing anything and being like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? That was the first time I wrote a mea culpa. It was, I released it. You can still find that on the SoundCloud too. It's called Inside the Bubble at the Daily Bitcoin.
I remember getting that idea.
Feel free to cut me off if I'm rambling, okay. By the way.
Well, everything's interesting, but there's no way I'm going to get through all my questions. I don't think. So I had no recollection that Andreas was a guest. So how did you find Andreas just to be a guest?
Let's see. So Andreas had been interested when I was looking for hosts, I think. I can't exactly remember. I remember that I had emailed back and forth with Andreas. Somehow, I don't recall how we originally came in contact. It might have been a response to, to what I was doing with the podcast. And basically, he went on vacation for a couple of weeks right after we had started talking. So we didn't actually get to meet, but I kind of got the sense that he had a background in journalism. And most of the people who I deal with in this space really don't have a background in journalism. I don't have a background in journalism either. So it fits right in. But that was really key, is that I had a pretty clear vision of what I wanted to do with this. race. And I think that Andreas was like, this is a vehicle that will help me accomplish the thing that I want to accomplish. It was serendipitous. You know, we did a lot of shows before we eventually met. And when we did meet, it was just like we were old friends. And that was true with Stephanie already, too.
Today's magic word is change. C-H-A-N-G-E. Use the magic word to claim your share of this week's LTB coin distribution on letstalkbitcoin.com. What's a typical day for you like?
I get up about 2 or 3 in the morning.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you go to sleep early or do you just not sleep much?
I go to sleep early, actually. I do. I like being up very early, and it lets me get stuff done, lets me be functional. I really pushed back a lot when people told me that I was going to wish that I had focused on one thing. And in hindsight, I do wish that I had focused on one thing, as opposed to doing what I've done, which is kind of use Let's Talk Bitcoin as a jumping off point. And then just expand into a bunch of different areas there and you know, look around. So, you know, on an average day, we record something with somebody, or I'll have consultations or a couple of consultations. I'm kind of an autodidact. I get interested in things and then I learn about them. So Wendell Davis from Hive and Humint turned me on to the Oculus Rift DK2. Kind of the renaissance in virtual reality, he said. It arrived about 2 weeks ago, and I've been absolutely floored by the similar opportunity that exists in the virtual reality space as to what exists in the Bitcoin space right now, which is to say that they're both disruptive technologies that enable things that previously were not expensive, but were simply impossible, and that actually are even more disruptive than they might otherwise be, because instead of inventing their own languages and, you know, requiring people to take special courses or go through academia in order to become experts, qualified experts on the topic, instead, actually, it's technology that just utilizes existing programming languages and just applies new venues to it. So the skills to create something that has never been created for are actually already basically commodified, which means that the cost to do it is quite cheap. For the last week or so, I've been talking with an independent developer in Germany about creating a prototype for me of a virtual reality media player, basically, that would let you import any other type of file into this virtual reality space and then place it various places and then interact with it in that space. And again, this is something that, you know, if you were talking about doing it pre-Oculus Rift, pre this VR movement, then it would have been really expensive because there are all of these different technologies that you simply have to invent. But now, because this technology exists and because it's, you know, not, it's not open source, but it's also not a closed source movement, and there are open source competitors out there making it unlikely for it ever to be fully monopolized, you know, the potential is just there to have that multiplier like you do with Bitcoin. With Bitcoin, you can do stuff that is otherwise impossible for, it's not only possible, but it's quite cheap. It's much the same way here.
So you've been spending a lot of time with this. And is that what you're saying?
Well, that's a long way of saying that I do a lot of things. I have a lot of different interests and I float quite a bit. And mostly I try to spend my time educating myself and sponging knowledge. It's not so much about Bitcoin anymore, because most of the stuff that is about Bitcoin, you know, in the news, isn't really about Bitcoin. It's more about the price. It's more about the regulation. And those are things that don't necessarily upset me, but they are a lot more reminiscent of the stuff that I'm not good at and the stuff isn't interesting to me. So it's been interesting to me. I bring up the Oculus thing because there are spaces out there that have similar opportunities to Bitcoin and that actually are closer to what Bitcoin used to be than to what it's becoming. And so that's interesting because Bitcoin, just because it's money, is very controversial. The other thing that I've been spending a lot of my time on is we're starting a company called Tokenly. Just did it, actually. signed general counsel and got started yesterday, had the kickoff meeting. That's a company that's focused on developing non-monetary uses of tokens. So this is like the booking systems. This is, you know, we're building a Venn type of solution that is able to take multiple types of tokens. Because the idea is that, you know, as an individual content creator, Rob, you might want to accept sponsor tokens, but you also might want to accept a sponsor token that you sell specifically. And you also might, you know, want to accept FLDC for the folding coin as one of the other means by which someone can buy a sponsor token. And that should be really, really easy for you to do. The only thing it should require of you is for you to specify, I, you know, want to sell this and this and this, and I want, and you know, these are the discounts that each one gets because I prefer this one more than this one. And here are the things that I'm, you know, willing to give for that. And so the point is that with these tools, it will eventually be easy, whereas right now it's incredibly difficult. So just like, you know, we didn't see the rush of crowdfunding campaigns in tokens until the model had kind of been proven and people saw, oh, this can be successful. It's much the same way here. So long as this is very difficult, it'll be difficult for people to pick it up and actually get into it. And so what I see is needed next is making it quite easy. I have had a lot of projects launch, and I have had a lot of projects that I would consider failures. And that's not to say that like it went away or they blew up or stole people's money or whatever, but that they didn't achieve what I had hoped that they would achieve. But just because something is a failure doesn't mean that it is not informative. And I mean, part of these have been informative about process. I've been involved with projects that have never launched, that you've never heard about, but that got quite far into development only to find, you know, that there were incompatibilities with parts of the team or whatever at a later point. So there's stuff like that where you learn about working with people. You know, it's been really interesting to me, the My Powers thing. You know, I've been on both sides of equity stuff at this point, right? So we're starting this company and we have equity relationships with people and partners. And I've been on, you know, the receiving end of equity, and it's been really, really informative. So that's really what I think that the value I've gotten out of this last year has been, is simply doing so many things in a kind of half-assed way where I just show up and I talk and I listen to people and I answer any questions of theirs that I feel like I can answer about the particular topics that I feel like I have a good perspective on, which is mostly this token stuff.
I felt like My Powers was kind of like, Swarm. Do you feel like those are similar projects? Swarm
I advised both of them.
Yeah. I mean, I almost felt like My Powers was your start, and then Swarm came along, and then as I felt almost like, oh, okay, well, I'll move on to another project.
There's a huge opportunity in crowdfunding, but it's a non-trivial problem. So there are a lot of different ways to approach that problem, you know, and that's really just what it was, is that My Powers is a different approach to the problem than Swarm's taken. And there's another player in this space who I think is going to be important, Coinify, Tom Ding's company, doing similar things, just focused slightly differently. It was interesting working with My Powers because over time, they actually got to be a lot more like what Let's Talk Bitcoin was. And so that caused some problems a little bit with our relationship, and wound up with me not having as large a part, because we're building this open source community platform built around community engagement and listener engagement, like I said earlier. And it, you know, and My Powers morphed from being a crowdfunding platform into a community engagement platform, where if you're Tatiana, well, instead of, you know, just having your community on your website, you can actually have it on the Coin Powers website, and they have, you know, the token controlled access stuff, that's all in there too. So it was sort of funny because we were talking about that stuff and developing that stuff basically simultaneously, independently for our own platforms. And then we would meet later and be like, oh, we're working on this. And I'd be like, oh, that's great. We're doing that too. And here's the open source version. You know, that contrasts with Swarm, which is focused on compliance, is focused on, you know, and is US based. So that makes them both interesting and a little bit scary at this particular juncture in time. Also due diligence focused. I thought that was really interesting, is, you know, Reddit and the internet has this great capacity for good, in that if you're lying about something, well, chances are pretty good the internet knows about it somewhere and can probably figure it out. So, you know, you take that concept and you apply it to crowdfunding projects. And I think that's pretty solid. That's an interesting idea that certainly can be gamed, but if it was tuned properly, probably could do a lot of good. The other player is Coinify. I just did an interview with them, so it's fresh in my mind. But the thing that they're doing that's different is, when you successfully crowdfund on their platform, you don't get the money up front. You essentially, when you are going to launch a project, you put out your milestones and your roadmap, basically. And then as the milestones are hit, you get the money that was allocated at the, you know, for the completion of that milestone. And so it provides this kind of lasting safeguard so that if a project goes badly off the rails, then the arbiters can say, oh, well, you know, you don't get this money because even though you were at the time milestone, you're not at the progress milestone. And it's not to say that like that means that the project will fail, but it gives leverage, whereas normally the process is, okay, well, here's a bunch of money and now fulfill your promise because otherwise your reputation is going to take a hit. So they're similar, you know. I mean, there's a lot of players in this space, and frankly, there's going to be a lot more. I'm surprised that there's only three main ones that I'm, you know, familiar with right now. But yeah, I mean, like, because again, it's just such a huge problem. The wild card in all of this is what happens with, you know, the next month in terms of the legality of these crowd sales, because there's been a suggestion that you need to spend several hundred thousand dollars basically securing an exemption to the accredited investor rule or accredited investor waiver. I don't recall the exact document, but whatever it is, you need to take steps as though you were a public company if you're crowdfunding in cryptocurrency. Whereas if you were doing it on Kickstarter or something, then, you know, you don't have to do that. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. So it's like this totally artificial, but still vexing problem. I'm not really focused that much on Bitcoin right this second. I mean, that really is a key thing, is that I'm getting up in the morning and I'm thinking about virtual reality these days for the last, you know, week and a half or so. So it's just like I'm really heads down right now, just waiting for whatever hammer falls to fall. And then, you know, figure from there, I'll be able to make an intelligent, you know, assessment of what should or shouldn't be done. But it's really nerve-wracking right now, because like I'm not even involved formally with any of these projects, but all the people who are going to be impacted by this stuff, like I've interviewed all of them, personal friends with a lot of them, you know, and I like the work that they're doing too. I mean, that's the thing about it, is that like the projects that are going to wind up being targeted are really very useful, net positive projects, and they're not being attacked, they're not going to be gone after because, you know, they're actually hurting people. They're going to be gone after because they violate obscure rules that are being made to apply to something that otherwise they wouldn't apply to. And that's, you know, that's crazy. But at the same time, it's like the natural response, right? I mean, like, what can the system do besides that? And so knowing that it's the natural response, it is a very difficult choice, I think, after a certain level of, you know, after a certain amount of stuff happens, to choose to stay in such an industry when there are other industries around that don't have the drama but do have the disruptive opportunity.
Well, that's a big thing to be saying.
It's a big thing to be saying, but, you know, I mean, like, it's crazy. It's crazy. If what looks like is going to happen in the next couple of weeks is going to happen, it's an act of war.
Can you be more specific what you're saying?
I just mean anybody who fundraised, like the reason why we didn't sell Let's Talk or LTB coin at all, why we didn't have any element of that, because it would have helped. It would have helped to have had, you know, a war chest of funds to be able to hire people to really be able to, you know, get going and not just fund ourselves as we had been doing before. But I had a lot of concern about what would happen if we fundraised, because once you go down that road, you can't undo it. You can't be like, all right, sorry, everybody, we're going to give the money back. Because if for no other reason than you spend. So what it looks like is going to happen, what the rumors have been, and I feel sadly, you know, confident in them, is that, you know, anybody who crowdfunded is going to have a legal issue, and not a small legal issue, a legal issue that intends to make a very strong point to people who are not being targeted. And it's already had a chilling effect. I mean, like, if you look at the space now compared to 3 weeks ago, it's very different. And, you know, we've already had it happen. We've already had it. We've already seen it. The impact in, you know, in our interviews, we did an interview with Suzanne Tempelhoff of BitNation. And, you know, like, that was an interview that if we had done it 6 months before, probably would have been very, very different. But because it had come after Swarm, because it had come after, you know, these concerns, and the attention of the US regulator had been, you know, had been identified as being on this type of project that uses this type of language, the standards totally changed. And unfortunately, you know, you could see it. You could see an entire episode that otherwise would have been about the project would have been about BitNation and the idea of governance on the blockchain and the idea of governance, you know, broadly, instead had more than half of it devoted to questions of, have you actually started a business? Can you set up a multi-sig address? You know, can you do all of these other things that are basically like laundry list checkpoints, not tremendously interesting. And yet we have to care, because to just talk about the exciting part and gloss over the business stuff in such an environment seems irresponsible. So, you know, I mean, like I hated having a disclaimer. I still hate having a disclaimer on the show, but I don't see any way around it. And, you know, it serves a small purpose in that it does reduce our liability a little bit. It tells people explicitly that we're not because we're not experts. And I don't want people to think we're experts. I just want people to think that if they like our perspective, if they find our perspective to be valuable and to resonate with them, that, you know, they then take that into their brain and process it. And, you know, it modifies their own perspective, if ever so slightly.
Do you think I should have a disclaimer?
I think that...
I don't seem like an expert as much.
Yeah, you know, this is very true. And again, like we haven't even mandated disclaimers for people. You know, the idea of a disclaimer to some people, you know, is kind of anathema, right? It's preemptive apologies for the thing that you're about to say, basically. You know, and they don't mean anything either, right? You're expecting people to listen whether or not you have the disclaimer in front. So really the only thing that it serves is just to protect your butt. So yeah, I think that if you're talking about things that are fundraise projects, that, you know, of projects that are soliciting money from people, it's very important to have you know, to have a disclaimer. Unfortunately, that again, like this just falls under that gigantic category of stuff that's totally irrelevant, not important at all to the, you know, meat of what it is that you're doing, the show that you're doing, and yet is one of the more important things that can bite you in the butt if it ever winds up doing it. And of course, it almost certainly never will, right? This is just fear. This is just a concern about the potential for something like this. But how can you, you know, how can we as adults who like our lives not act in a way that does everything to prevent the worst from happening?
Do you have some kind of liability insurance, errors and omissions or something like that?
We've sought liability insurance a couple of times, and it's been very difficult, explicitly because we have Bitcoin in the name of the company. That was difficult and very difficult to find. And the insurance that we did find really didn't cover any of the stuff that we needed. It was like, you know, insurance except for, you know, like if somebody sues you for saying something, right? I mean, so it's like that's totally useless to a journalistic outfit. It's just a reality of the space right now. And it's such a distraction. And like, it sucks that that's the thing that I have to think about when I'm thinking about this stuff, as opposed to just thinking about what is possible now that wasn't possible before and how do we do it.
As a very new podcaster on your network, I've been kind of unclear about many things. So here's my chance to ask you.
Please.
Are there any guidelines that I'm supposed to follow as a podcaster on the Let's Talk Bitcoin network?
Yeah, it's a lot about the market. We do maintain, again, like everything that we do as far as quality controls are really about quality and not about content. So like if the quality is really bad, then, you know, consistently, then I might have to talk to you. I might say, hey, this is, you know, not good. You need to increase the quality. But other than that, you know, like, people sometimes talk about bias, or sometimes you'll hear people say, I'm not biased. And I think that that's a little bit of a difficult statement to conclusively make, because we are all inherently biased. Bias is just a product of perspective, and the perspective is a product of our each unique experiences and how we've reacted to each of them. So the guideline is tell the truth, be interesting, and have something to say.
I've not been interested in trying to monetize or have ads. I mean, I figure I'm just getting my feet wet. That seems like a complication to me. Could I do anything I want as far as collecting money in any format, any advertiser, anything I want to do?
I think that for now, we're very, very open. There are general, you know, guidelines on the network. So we don't take gambling. We don't take adult content. We don't take weapons. Basically anything that you think is, you know, something that would be highly questionable, whether or not, you know, a normal site would accept it as a sponsor, we probably don't. The brand is one of the few things, you know, everything we do is open source. So the brand is one of the few things that I've been quite possessive of. And that is just because I think that it's quite valuable. And I think that I've done a good job, and that we've broadly done a good job of putting good content on the air, building a good reputation of not, you know, taking money from people and then saying nice things about them or whatever. And so that's really it, is, you know, just don't be dishonest, and probably what you're doing is going to be consistent with what I want you to do.
You mentioned there are some guidelines. Are those written down anywhere that I could see them?
Yeah, you'd think that. So this is the issue, is we have standards, but they're in various states of disrepair, and just everything is in progress. That's really been the thing, is that launching LTB coin when we did, I don't regret doing it, but it hasn't been the boon that I had hoped to a certain extent that it would be. And that is not necessarily because of the token. The token part has worked fine. With the exception of 1 week where we were unable to get into the wallet to do the issuance on time.
So with a LTB coin, I think it's tricky. You got to be careful of people gaming the system, I guess, as far as the listener rewards and stuff. But you also introduced tokens for ads, which I think at first seemed like a good idea to me. But now I'm wondering, I have more than one of those ad tokens for display ads because they seem valuable. I feel like they will hold their value, because they are pegged to an ad on your website, on the LTB website. So it seems, and I haven't wrapped my head around it, but it almost seems like that makes the LTB coin value less associated with the pegged values of ads on the network.
The issue isn't the tokens, right? Creating the sponsor token wasn't the problem. The problem is that we don't have the support systems built yet. What it's eventually going to look like, Rob, is you'll buy a sponsor token with either LTB coin or Bitcoin or whatever other arbitrary thing. You know, like if you want to sell your own, then you'll be able to do that too. And if we decide that, yes, this is a token that the network should value, then maybe we'll accept that too. You might have heard of Vend. Vend is Jeremy Lamb's project, and it's basically a vending machine type bot.
Is that out yet?
Oh, yeah. It is out in some form yet. But the point is that it's the first solution that is out. And it's not perfect in every situation, and it doesn't do everything. It does a very specific thing. It lets you send Bitcoin or something else, although most of the installations are just Bitcoin, and then receive back another token after four confirmations-ish. So, like, that's one of the first core services that has come out for tokens, and it's one of about four or five that are pretty desperately needed. We need redemption services. We need booking services. We need scheduling services. We need, the auction system right now only can accept certain types of tokens. It can't accept Bitcoin. So there's just kind of all of this basic stuff that once we have it, it gets a lot easier to do this, because yes, it feels like the LTB coin is maybe not as valuable, but at the same time, if you can buy a sponsor token at a fixed price for either Bitcoin or 75% of the value in LTB coin or 50% of the value in LTB coin, then doesn't that differential, if someone would pay Bitcoin, that means that makes the LTB coin more valuable. I call these market pegs or soft peg. I don't know. Anyways, we get back into the part where I don't actually have that much of an economic background. I just look at systems and try to see things that I think where incentives align or where things make sense. Mm-hmm.
So my sense was you were really hoping, like I know Brian is or was acting like an agency function. I know other people have talked about that. Were you really hoping that would kind of take off and form itself to perform some functions?
Well, there were a couple of things that happened. One has been the continually drifting down price of Bitcoin. We've had our most successful sponsor runs when the price has been on an uptick, because people feel like they're wealthy and feel like it's okay to spend. Whereas now it's like, oh, well, why would I, you know, I can't justify it as an advertising expense because, you know, we're already losing a lot of our capital simply because the value of Bitcoin is going down. So certainly that's something that I've felt both, you know, on the receiving sponsors and also on the wanting to sponsor stuff ourselves or wanting to make purchases ourselves. As far as the distribution network is concerned, I think that there's a huge potential for token distribution networks, basically, that have audiences and find interesting projects that are built using tokens and buy the tokens in bulk from, you know, the project and then resell them into their audience. I think that there is a huge eventual market there. And we have seen people who have picked up and done this. But again, the problem is just that everything is manual, and where I would have liked it to have only taken 2 months for us to get from manual to automatic. We are, in fact, only just now starting on some of the core systems that are required, because token-controlled access wound up taking a long time. That's the thing that I keep coming back to, is that we take a step forward and and we're immediately boxed in by walls all around us. And, you know, you have to break through that wall in order to, whichever way you go, there's like not a wrong direction necessarily, but you have to go through it in order to understand the requirements of what next. And so that's just a very slow process, relatively speaking.
And if a potential advertiser wanted to advertise on Let's Talk Bitcoin, like, and they didn't really know who to reach out to, I feel like right now, if they looked at the website, I don't know how they would know what to do. What should an advertiser do if he wants to advertise on your podcast?
Yeah, I know, right? You know, it's hard right now because the amount of money that we acquire relative to the amount of work it takes in order to field a sponsorship is not insubstantial. And so once it becomes automated, then it will be much, much easier. You'll visit a page for sponsorship and you'll see a calendar that'll have all of the different availabilities on it and the different bookings. You'll just select the one that you want and you'll be prompted to enter your information about what the sponsorship is and then push it through essentially by sending your sponsor token. And if you don't have a sponsor token, then on the same page, there will be an address that you can send a stated amount of Bitcoin or LTB coin to and it'll give you back a sponsor token. Or you can acquire it from somewhere else. We're still going to be doing the auctions. What we're creating is a multi-level system. People who want to acquire the thing for the lowest price go the deepest into the system, jump through the most hoops. And then from there, they have the ability of either using what they acquired for cheap because they got it cheap and can just take advantage of that savings. It's not really savings. Again, like they just put more work into it. They are more involved with process. But it also means that because these are tokens, instead of just somebody necessarily going in and saying, okay, well, I've achieved a great price, but it's only because I have this thing I want to advertise. Instead, you can have this redistributor type of system where, you know, Dave Allen, you know, is working with a couple of different projects that all are looking to sponsor. And so he's been acquiring sponsor tokens and they're, you know, he's managing all of that stuff for them. And I assume he's taking a cut as a result. So that's all good for me because it means that that's work I don't have to do. Whenever we've had sponsors in the past, it's always a back and forth that relies on me. And, you know, like that's why we don't do editorial consent on sponsorships anymore. Just all of these steps that add time to the process. And at a certain point, it might be worth it to do that because the money it brings in is significant. But right now, really, the intent is just to test the system. That's also why I haven't really encouraged any of the other shows to get into this stuff yet. It's just hard.
Are you really wanting to monetize right now, or is this really a long-term project and that's not even a big goal at the moment?
For LTB coin, the goal hasn't really been to monetize it. The goal is to experiment with it and to see what problems, again, like it's that, you know, if you have to walk through it in order to see what comes next, this is the easiest, cheapest, lowest risk way that we can walk through it and see what we need to do next.
I guess I'm thinking more of the network, though. You have bills to pay. I mean, are you going for the long term or are you?
We're definitely in this for the long term as far as monetization of the network is concerned. The network, again, is an experiment.
So me with my little podcast, what am I contributing to the network?
It costs us almost nothing for you to be here. The value that you give isn't necessarily the important question right now, because the issue is that you're here. So if you succeed, right, we've given you a kind of a jump start, you know, whereas normally you would struggle with your first couple of episodes because it's hard to find people who are actually willing to devote time to listening to something that hasn't essentially already been vetted for them. We kind of let you skip that step. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you're going to succeed. You have to actually find a way to be that resonates with people and resonates, frankly, with our audience. So it's not like we're necessarily giving you anything outside of an opportunity to do good work. So that's kind of always been the goal with Let's Talk Bitcoin, is to give people a platform to do good work. And the thing that we found, or the thing that I found, I guess last December, was that there aren't enough hours in the day. I mean, right now, as we speak, you know, we've got an episode going out today, and I have another 3 weeks of shows, six episodes fully piled up, ready to go, basically. And again, that's not because we take every interview that comes along. It's because there are a ridiculous amount of things that need to be talked about. And, you know, that doesn't include my co-host saying that they want to do just more host segments, too. So there's so much to talk about. And there's so much that we can't talk about, if for no other reason than our perspectives are our own, and we cannot reflect the perspectives of other people. That if the goal is to have the most complete picture of reality, then the solution, at least from my perspective, is to have the largest number of eyes on it, describing it verbally and talking about it with each other in a way that everybody can hear and make their own decisions about.
It seems like a really good deal from my perspective.
Well, I think that's the part about all of this open source stuff, you know, because again, like another thing is that when you publish with us, we don't own it. You still own it, but we do ask you to put it out under open source. So you don't really own it. Nobody really owns it. It's just kind of out there. So it's about building the library. And I mean, there are just a lot of different, there's just no downside to including more shows. If you were doing a show that like was detrimental to the network or, you know, was like, hey, all these other people on the network are terrible, then like that would be detrimental. But outside of that, I just can't really think of many situations. Even if you're negative about Bitcoin, that still is a useful perspective. Okay. I'd like to have a system that makes podcasters feel like they have a good system to work in and that it's easy and they can just focus on the podcasting. Because that's, again, the thing that has been emphasized to me over and over again is that there's this gigantic waste of time that's called everything you don't do well. And it's different for each person. And so for podcasters, again, like a lot of times you just want to focus on content. A lot of times you're not an editor. You know, I mean, like that's a skill set that I got, frankly, you know, lucky with and that I'm quite happy that I enjoy doing it because it's allowed me to do this stuff even when I'm bored because I like editing other people. You know, I like editing audio.
I like editing audio because it fixes a lot of things I mess up on.
Totally. Editing is the only way. In this space, there was such a high concentration of people who were really intelligent and really incapable of presenting their ideas in a way that was easy to understand for the, you know, normal person. That was really the thing that made me edit. I totally, you know, I would never do it a different way.
I hope to someday have to edit less of my own speaking.
Well, it gets easier if you notice it. You know, if you make yourself aware of it, then it gets easier to do it. I'm terrible with it, though. That's why I always edit.
So I'm not even clear what metrics are being measured or paid attention to.
LTB is a combination of page views of the posted page. We can't track downloads in a way that won't be easily gamed. So we decided early on that we were not going to explicitly track downloads. Nor do we explicitly track plays. The things that we track are people visiting the page, you know, its content page, and then also the magic words. And magic words have a pretty heavy weighting relative to the page views. And again, that's a metric that's growing over time and that we're transitioning into. It's really hard to judge podcasts because podcasts, you know, like if somebody downloads it, you can't tell if they listen to it. If they click the play button, it counts as a play, but you can't tell how much they listen to. So that's really where the impetus for Magic Words came from, is that even if you look at something like radio, actually, so we were on radio for, I guess, about 3 months. Actually, this is why we stopped with the radio stuff, was because it was impossible to tell what sort of impact we were having. We didn't have magic words at that point. So, you know, it was really, again, like if you think about it, radio is not only a medium of last resort, right? It's something that you only listen to when you have absolutely no other option. But it's a broadcast medium. It's a push medium. And so trying to count how many people are tuning in or receiving it is insane. And I mean, furthermore, the types of audiences you get with radio compared to a podcast is totally different. Again, people have to seek out a podcast, so they tend to consume more of it, where radio, the average listener from, you know, my talks with the station manager, turns on, listens to maybe 10 minutes in the middle of an hour randomly. And so like, that's why when you listen to the radio, you know, you're constantly hearing, this is blah, 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 and we're talking about blah, 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 is because they're expecting you to have not been listening 3 minutes ago. Uh-huh. So it's a hard problem. I've basically been looking at Let's Talk Bitcoin from a technology standpoint as kind of a listener engagement platform, honestly, because once you have that, right, once you have the token and the distribution mechanism for the token, then, you know, if it's a radio station, well, why couldn't they get their radio personalities and once a month, you know, they auction off a dinner with one of the radio personalities for the token? It's a simple way that would actually give it real tangible value for people who really care about it. And then that tangible value gives a market to it to people who don't necessarily care about it, but have some and wouldn't mind trading it for money.
So I'm going to assume you haven't been keeping up on my podcast. I don't know if you have any general or specific tips just for me and going forward.
think that it's about finding your voice and finding your niche. I think that a lot of shows start off in kind of how you are, which is that you don't really have too much of a perspective. You're kind of you're asking people questions because you're, this is not to say you don't have a perspective, but you're not necessarily attached to your perspective as the right one. And I think that that after you've talked to a lot of people and you've seen a lot of things, certainly for me, there's a temptation to think that you're right about a lot of things. And that's good and it's bad, but it's just a different perspective. So I think that, you know, the show that you do, don't expect it to stay the same. Expect it to change and let it change as your interests change.
Thanks so much for your time, Adam.
Talk to you later, Rob.
I hope you enjoyed hearing Adam talking about his own stuff for a change. What you may not realize is you just heard less than half of our actual conversation. What was the other half, you may wonder? Well, Adam went off on really long tangents to just about every question I asked. And then he even would lose his train of thought. Throughout our talk, we both joked about how much work this was going to be for me to edit into a usable podcast. And here I expected the master of Bitcoin podcasting to be a piece of cake to interview.
Man, I keep losing my train halfway
through. That's okay.
Rob, if you want to take this whole thing again, we can do that too.
I don't know. I really don't know how. I don't know how this will come out. What do you think?
I like to do wide-ranging interviews with people, but they tend to be people who are less verbose. I'm very verbose.
I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I really do thank Adam for what he's brought to the Bitcoin ecosystem, for his support, and for allowing me the opportunity to have my own podcast on the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. And I also thank you all for listening. See you next time.
Yeah, Bitcoin's poop on your head.